face of a huge voter turnout. And I say huge. We won because we harnessed the energy and the excitement that the Democratic Party will need to succeed in November.
So how did a little-known U.S. senator from Vermont turn into a huge winner in New Hampshire? Let's find out. From New Hampshire Public Radio, it's Primarily Politics. I'm Brady Carlson. We're wrapping up the New Hampshire primary in two episodes, sort of like a double-length season finale. On this show, we're looking at the Democratic primary. We'll also pull back the curtain and share some of our favorite moments from covering the 2016 campaign. But first, let's get caught up with the Democratic returns in three words. Word number one is burn. It was felt in just about every part of New Hampshire, in just about every demographic category. UNH political scientist Dante Scala says the Sanders campaign even won with some of the groups Team Clinton had been courting heavily.
According to exit polls, women were 55% of the Democratic primary vote today, and Sanders won that category by 11 percentage points.
Word number two is ready. Hillary Clinton came up short in her bid to win a second New Hampshire primary. Her message to supporters on primary night was, this is only one step on the way to the nomination.
We're going to fight for every vote in every state. We're going to fight for real solutions that make a real difference in people's lives.
Word number three is two. While this is really a two-person race, there were dozens of other names on the ballot, each garnering a handful of votes. If you remember our interview a few weeks back with Vermin Supreme, where he vowed to crush Martin O'Malley, well, according to the vote totals, that didn't happen. Then again, Vermin Supreme is still running, and Martin O'Malley left after Iowa, so make of that what you will. But back to the big questions on the Democratic side. How did we get to where we are now, and what might happen next? I got some answers and a few questions from two people who know the primary inside and out. Dante Scala, political scientist at the University of New Hampshire, and Public Radio's political junkie, Ken Rudin. Bernie Sanders started this campaign, I want to say, just under a year ago. I remember going to one of his first house parties, just a normal house, and there was a crowd out on the lawn. You could say it was a nice day, but you could also say if you knew what was coming, you could start to see that there was maybe more to the Sanders campaign than initially thought.
I would make the case that when I saw him in the beginning, I think he was there to make a statement that there was a lot of unhappiness in the last 7 years, even though it's a Democrat in the White House. The rich have gotten richer. The poor have gotten poorer. Income inequality has not gone away. The progressive wing in the Democratic Party needed a candidate to express those views. And then somehow these small meetings in living rooms and houses became massive showings of turnout. Tens of thousands of people in states that aren't, not even Iowa, New Hampshire, but states around the country that may not even have an early primary. So we knew fairly early, but shockingly so, that there was something more to it than just a protest vote.
And the protest vote was sort of the common shorthand, Dante, about the Sanders campaign. But it seems like the exit polling data that we've seen so far suggests there's more going on, at least in New Hampshire.
Yeah, I mean, what's stunning, frankly, is the breadth of Sanders support. That he's not just doing well in college towns among the young people. We thought he would do that. He's not just doing well among upscale progressive voters. We thought he would do that. But also among kind of moderate blue-collar voters, that he has succeeded where so many others have failed in uniting more upscale Democrats with Democrats of more modest means and put together that message, which really has left Clinton, remarkably. I mean, Clinton has always been seen a friend of New Hampshire. It saved Bill Clinton. It saved Hillary Clinton.
Clinton country, it's been called.
This is a very unhappy coda to the Clinton history of New Hampshire.
And we heard former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking earlier tonight, and she said, regardless of the results tonight, I quote, I still love New Hampshire. Shortly after that, Vermont U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders spoke to his supporters in Concord. Let's hear some of what he had to say.
Together, we have sent the message that will echo from Wall Street to Washington, from Maine to California. And that is that the government of our great country belongs to all of the people and not just a handful of wealthy campaign contributors and their super PACs.
That's Vermont U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders speaking earlier tonight in Concord, declaring victory in New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation presidential primary. Ken Rudin, one thing that's interesting is that here you have a candidate who started, as you say, as a protest candidate, speaking out about these issues, the 1% and the billionaire class, which is not necessarily something new. We heard a lot of that 8 years ago in the 2008 presidential primary. But at a time when the economic indicators, which largely drive a lot of the Democratic primary voters, are so different from what they were at the start of the Great Recession. I mean, hiring is up, gas prices are down. Some of those pocketbook issues that we normally look to maybe don't tell all the tale here.
Well, that's a very good point. And that's what Hillary Clinton supporters have been saying from the beginning, that think of what, and Hillary Clinton, of course, is trying to sell herself as a third Obama term. Look what's happened since 2008, 2009, when Barack Obama came into office. The Bush economy was in tatters. The financial system was about to collapse. Katrina, food prices, gas prices, wars that were just not coming close to ending. And so in many ways, you could say that the Obama record, including the passage of the Affordable Care Act, was just a tremendous victory for the Democratic Party. But as not only as Bernie Sanders would say, but as many people would say, that income inequality is the same. The amount of money I'm making in my job is not nearly what I was making a long time ago. I still have fears about my financial future. So yes, is Obama's economy better than the Bush economy? Democrats will say absolutely yes. Am I still nervous about the future? Absolutely yes. And Bernie Sanders capitalized on that.
You know, it's remarkable. Bill Clinton was deployed around New Hampshire to try to help his wife come back here in the state. And he was quoted as complaining rather wistfully, this is not the New Hampshire I knew. Bernie Sanders would not be doing well in the New Hampshire I knew. And a quarter century ago, Bill Clinton was the candidate who was going to lead the Democrats back to the center after Michael Dukakis and other liberal candidates had failed. And that's something Clinton largely did. And now, a quarter century later, his wife and Bernie Sanders are arguing about who's the more authentic, trustworthy progressive. You know, that all that talk about moderation is a relic of the Democratic Party.
It's also interesting, too, in that the Clinton campaign lately characterized the race as, well, we understand that we're behind because Bernie Sanders is from Vermont, which neighbors New Hampshire. And his relationship with New Hampshire has never been quite that way.
Yeah, I mean, Bernie Sanders' backyard of New Hampshire is much less crowded than, say, a Massachusetts governor's backyard. I mean, the Connecticut River Valley is important to the Democratic Party, but it's sparsely populated. I mean, that's a rural area. Bernie Sanders has done well across the state. I mean, from Keene out to Somersworth and Portsmouth, it's a sweeping tide that, you know, it's like the earth is moving beneath your feet and nothing quite looks the same after the earthquake.
Interesting question about the ground games, too, because the feeling was is that the Clinton campaign would have stronger field offices, they would have more volunteers, they would be better organized. And Bernie Sanders said in his victory speech that we had very little organization. In fact, when I first covered him at that House party in Manchester, he said, we're going to have to knock on a lot of doors. We're not going to have the money that our opponents are going to have. We're just going to have to count on the grassroots. And in the end, he had grassroots and he had some money.
Remember 8 years ago when Hillary Clinton lost and she said, basically, when she was gearing up for 2016, her people said, we'll never be out-organized again. I don't know if she was out-organized. I think she still had a strong ground game out there, but the emotion, the passion for Bernie Sanders was much greater.
One of the issues, though, in that 2008 campaign, Dante, was that the Obama campaign had better done the calculus, essentially, in the Democratic field. They had played the superdelegate game perhaps a little bit better. Those party officials who have their own delegates that they can add to the total count, they were stronger in the caucus states. Despite tonight's results, Hillary Clinton has a huge advantage in superdelegates, a huge advantage in those establishment endorsements. And so the question is, if this does wind up just being a race between delegates, you know, is feeling the burn going to be enough to go up against that kind of organization and that kind of backing?
Yeah, superdelegates, I imagine, who are pledged to Clinton, and that's all it is. It's just a pledge. They might be looking over their shoulder a bit because, let's say, Sanders keeps winning states and you're a superdelegate from a state that Sanders won. Are you really going to go against the people of your state and go with Hillary Clinton? I mean, that's a problem. You know, you can talk about these superdelegate leads, but they have a way of evaporating if there's a act of democratic will, so to speak, and Sanders keeps winning.
And that's exactly what happened in 2008. In the beginning, Hillary Clinton had all the superdelegates, all the elected officials. As Barack Obama started to win, to show that he was the real deal, a lot of those superdelegates broke away from her and went to Barack Obama.
That's UNH political scientist Dante Scala and Public Radio's political junkie Ken Rudin. Coming up, the dumbest question any reporter asked of any candidate in the entire primary, and I was the one who asked it. It's Primarily Politics from New Hampshire Public Radio.
If you are interested in this podcast, you would probably love our new iPhone app. It is all about politics. It is called State of Democracy. Go to the iTunes store right now and search for State of Democracy and download it today.
I'm Brady Carlson. Welcome back. We're wrapping up the Democratic presidential primary in this episode of the show. There is also a Republican episode. This is like when the Superman comic books had a red Superman with his normal powers and the blue Superman with those weird energy powers. Yep, that's what this is. Anyway, primary 2016 is behind us. The candidates have moved on, and all we have left are our memories and maybe some pictures. In fact, there are quite a few New Hampshire residents who spent this campaign taking pictures of or with all of the candidates. I talked with some of them to find out why and to find out whether those pictures reveal something about the candidates who run for president or at least about the people who try to take their photos.
So we went to a Chris Christie endorsement and I had my iPod that only can take selfies. So I was like, why not get a selfie with him? And so we went back into the car, and Addie said, why not get him with everyone? Because we're going to be dragged along to see them anyway, so might as well make it fun.
I also had Pokemon on the brain, so I just wanted to take...
Catch them all.
Catch them all, Mom.
Everybody knows in New Hampshire that politics is our state sport. What I realized was the candidates' campaign speeches weren't what was interesting about the events. What's great, though, is when the candidates, either when they come in or when they're ready to leave, they'll interact with the voters one-on-one. And that's when all the magic happens at these events. The candidates either do or don't connect with the voters when they're trying to talk to them one-on-one and answer their questions or sign photographs or whatever they're doing. And I decided that I was going to try to capture those moments when the candidates try to connect with people. So I might be there for 2 hours, but all I care about is that last 2 minutes.
The competition to get to the candidate is so much tougher now. Everybody wants a selfie. You need to get in one of the front few rows, and then the second the candidate says, okay, thank you very much, you need to jump up like a rabbit and be right there in the scrum without being obnoxious, but still being aggressive and assertive. And it's a real fine balance.
Just be really assertive. Make eye contact with the candidate or their helper.
Seem really engaged in what they're talking about. Don't seem like, oh.
Be engaged. Don't seem engaged.
Just be like, oh, what am I going to do tonight?
Yeah, like, try to make eye contact, get on their good side.
Maybe you can be in the White House. Who knows?
I never had to go up to a candidate. And the reason is that I'm a wheelchair user. Candidates make a beeline for me in any room. And I would say, so I'm doing this photo series on candidates interacting with voters. Feel free to just ignore me.
Thanks to Emmy and Addie Nozell, Darren Garnick, and Roger Gown for sharing their stories of photos on the First in the Nation trail. This New Hampshire primary has been one for the record books. Just about anything that could have happened pretty much did, and because it's our job to cover what happens, our reporters have seen it all. like this story from NHPR's Jason Moon.
It comes from a VFW hall where Marco Rubio was campaigning, and I was there early, and his campaign was kind of setting up all of the set pieces that go with a normal campaign event. They were setting up the kind of background to all the photos he would be in during his stump speech. Basically, you know, a piece of fabric hoisted on to two poles with the Marco Rubio campaign logo. One of the campaign staffers grabbed this, what I thought was a vacuum cleaner, but like turned out to be some kind of like steam cleaner. He proceeded to meticulously steam clean the fabric backdrop. And it took me a few minutes to realize, but he was steam cleaning it to get all of the wrinkles out of it for all of the photos that would be taken. And I guess they didn't want to have a wrinkled Marco Rubio logo. It took the guy maybe like 20, 25 minutes. And I just remember thinking, like, what could possibly be going through his head right now? And I'll just never forget that there are these people who, for reasons I don't really understand fully, you know, would commit to doing things like this for a candidate, for a campaign. Well, then again, maybe he's getting paid a ton of money. I have no idea. It's just a little window into the minds and the lives of people who make these campaigns run. And that one will stick with me.
As for me, I think I asked the dumbest question of any reporter talking to any candidate in the course of the primary. This is a story involving Lindsey Graham, and every reporter who's covered the primary has a Lindsey Graham story. It was shortly after Donald Trump had given out Lindsey Graham's cell phone number. As a result of that, Lindsey Graham was getting cell phone calls from just about every corner of the universe. There was a detail in the Washington Post about how the phone had kept ringing even as Lindsey Graham had gone out to the movies with New Hampshire U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte and her kids. But the best detail in the story was that they were going to the movies to see Minions. And the idea of Lindsey Graham, very personable, loved retail politics, but also talked about some serious business like,
whatever it takes, as long as it takes, to destroy radical Islam is what I will do.
Had gone out to see the Minions movie of all movies. And so I got it in my head that I had to find out what he thought about that movie.
How did you like Minions?
Okay, so I love Minions. It wasn't as good as the book, but I loved it. So,
it's maybe not the most substantive question I ever asked, but at least now you know what Lindsey Graham thought of the Minions movie. And I think on that note, that's all for this edition of Primarily Politics. Don't forget to check out our wrap-up of the Republican primary if you haven't done so already. We had help with this show from Sarah Ashworth, Peter Biello, Dan Colgan, Ellen Grimm, Rebecca Lavoie, Andrew Perella, Taylor Quimby, and Michael Rathke. If you'd like to enjoy the primary all over again, check out our past episodes on iTunes, Audioboom, and NHPR.org. If you enjoyed the show, leave a review on any of those sites or let me know on Twitter. I'm at Brady Carlson, all one word. Thanks so much for listening to Primarily Politics. And remember, Primary 2016 may be over, but Primary 2020 has just begun.